Smoking even one cigarette a day is not a good idea.
Heart attacks after the flu.
Are we over-treating people with diabetes?
And drugs to treat thyroid disorders causing birth defects.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed TT, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center at El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, since we're having such a really ferocious flu season, I saw just this morning in the medical headlines this issue relative to, goodness, since 2009, it hasn't been this bad. Why don't we turn right to the New England Journal of Medicine, a look at, wow, do we get sequela of the flu that may include heart attack?
These investigators looked at 364 different hospitalizations for heart attack that occurred within 1 year before or 1 year after the flu. And what they recognize is that when people have the flu, the week following the diagnosis, they're six times more likely to have a heart attack than during periods where they don't have the flu.
Here's a truly astonishing number. I need to hear a little more about this. What exactly did they assess?
So they identified individuals that presented with a heart attack and also had laboratory confirmed flu. And what they said was, is there a temporal relationship between those two events? And what they discovered was when people develop the flu, or more broadly, even other respiratory viral conditions, they were much more likely to have a heart attack than when they didn't have the viral infection. By the way, this is true for influenza A and influenza B, but also true for other viral infections like respiratory syncytial virus. Now, this shouldn't be terribly surprising because we know that these viral respiratory conditions cause an inflammatory condition, and we know that inflammation can actually cause heart attacks, that is, rupture of a plaque followed by a clot forming inside that artery. But what may be most surprising is how robust it is. A six-fold increase in the risk of heart attacks within a week of the flu is pretty significant.
No assessments of inflammatory factors?
No, not in this particular study. This was a retrospective study, but other studies have clearly shown that flu and other respiratory viral diseases cause an increase in inflammation.
My guess is about the only thing we can do about this is get a flu vaccine.
Well, in fact, the evidence is very good for people with heart disease. The flu vaccine actually decreases their mortality. So everybody with cardiovascular disease should be getting a flu vaccine. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Okay. From here, why don't we go to one I'm going to serve up? I said, wow, even one cigarette a day, what a bad idea. This was in the British Medical Journal. It was a meta-analysis of 55 publications, 141 cohort studies. And basically, once they crunched all the numbers, they found that there was still an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, even among those who only smoked a single cigarette. And that was in comparison to those who smoked 20 cigarettes a day. The risk was about half among those who only smoked one in comparison to those who smoked 20, which seems really disproportional. The risk was higher for women in general than it was for men, and I love the author's conclusion. They say there is no safe level of smoking that exists for cardiovascular disease.
To look at it a different way, Elizabeth, men who smoke one cigarette per day have almost a 50% higher risk of heart disease and a 25% higher risk of stroke than people that smoke nothing. That's just with one cigarette. And as you mentioned, the risk is even higher in women, almost a 60% increased risk of heart disease and a 31% increased risk for stroke by just smoking one cigarette a day. That is pretty remarkable. I think most people would say, well, gosh, if I just smoke one cigarette per day or two or three, it can't be that bad compared to smoking a pack or two. But what the evidence shows is there's still a significant increased risk of heart disease and stroke with even one cigarette.
This study, of course, makes me happy because it just accretes to my public health message of all cigarettes should be abolished.
For those individuals that are already smoking, they say, well, I'll do well if I can just decrease the amount. And there is some truth to that. But what you have to do is you have to be committed to actually stopping smoking altogether if you're going to lower your risk substantially.
Well, I guess a follow-up study to this one would be, is there a dose response relative to the risk of COPD and lung cancer?
There is an association between the number of cigarettes smoked and COPD and with lung cancer as well. But again, there's no safe amount.
Let's move on then to your other one. And that's this look at thyroid drugs and, gosh, do they increase birth defects? That's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
Since up to 1% of pregnant women can have Graves' disease, that's hyperthyroidism, the treatment of that and how it might cause birth defects is really important. So in this Korean study, they looked at almost 3 million completed pregnancies between 2008 and 2014 and identified almost 13,000 women that were taking these anti-thyroid medications to treat Graves' disease. And what they discovered was, in fact, that the use of them does increase the risk of birth defects. The two biggest medications used are one called propylthiouracil, or PTU, and the other called methimazole, or MMI. And the risk is lower with PTU. It increases the risk of birth defects by about 20% versus 40% with MMI, but both of them are associated with an increased risk of birth defects. It's important not to avoid treating it because untreated hyperthyroidism can also cause birth defects and stillbirths as well. So what this tells us is that we need to actually plan pregnancies and we need to talk about contraception during the time when women are receiving treatment or look at alternative ways of treating it that don't involve medications, for example, surgery or using radioactive iodine during the time that contraception is given.
Is it safe for women to go off of these thyroid medicines while they're pregnant?
No, and in fact, they're probably most teratogenic or most likely to cause birth defects during the first trimester. And that's why I mentioned that we need to actually do planning beforehand.
How is it that we haven't known this before?
There actually have been some studies that have suggested it, relatively small studies and case control trials. The nice thing about this study is it captures all births across Korea because they have a national health system and medical care is relatively inexpensive. So looking at 13 million births allows you to detect even small increases. So for example, the normal rate of birth defects in this population was about 6%. With the use of these medications, it increased 7.3%. So you need to have millions of births or tens of thousands of women taking this medication to detect it.
Powerful stuff. Finally, let's turn to our last one, fairly powerful also, not quite that powerful. In Diabetes, Obesity, and Metabolism, a BMJ journal, they took a look at just over 1,000 Dutch patients who had diabetes. They were over the age of 70 years, and they found some pretty remarkable stuff. In spite of changes in the guidelines with regard to management of diabetes and the necessity to really personalize treatment, they found that a large number of these folks were on five or more medicines. A lot of them were frail. Those who had those particular constellation of findings also experienced more hypoglycemic events and falls. And even when those things took place, the falls and the hypoglycemic events, their treatment was not de-intensified following that. So these Dutch researchers conclude that, in spite of the fact that we're personalizing treatments for people with diabetes, that hasn't really penetrated the common man yet.
The Diabetes Association has recommended personalized treatment. So if you're over the age of 70 and you're only using metformin, your goal for hemoglobin A1C should be 7 or less. If you're using more medications, but you've had diabetes for less than 10 years and you're over the age of 70, then the goal should be a hemoglobin A1C of less than 7.5. If you have multiple medications, you've had diabetes for more than 10 years, then the goal should be 8 or less. So it should be very personalized. But what this study shows is we don't personalize it. Oftentimes we give intensive therapy to the population that's most vulnerable, the frail and on multiple medications. And as you mentioned, it causes significant problems, hypoglycemia and falls in the elderly. Those can be life-threatening. And even when we recognize it, we don't alter our therapy. So this is really important news for the elderly individuals that have diabetes. Is their diabetes care should be personalized to try to prevent complications.
I thought it was really noteworthy in this study among those patients they identified as overtreated, their hemoglobin A1C was an average of 6.5%, well below the guideline.
Exactly. I mean, the guidelines suggest 8 or less because you say, well, why not treat it more intensively? Well, because it causes more complications, increases the risk to the patient.
I guess one of my concerns is it's hard to put the onus on a patient, especially a frail older person with multiple comorbidities who's on 5+ medicines, to go to their primary care doc and say, hey, wait, I think I'm taking too much stuff. Maybe we need to relax some of this.
You're right. And so the onus really falls on the healthcare provider, but it's important for our listeners who are patients to be aware of this as well. We talk about personalized medicine. We think about genetic issues and how do we assign what someone's genetic risk is. This is also personalized medicine based upon a person's age and their risk factors as well. Every bit as important as any genetic information.
On that note, I'm going to do the just one cigarette a day, just say no, this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.